Chapter 4. As he sank back into his seat, he thought how differently Anna Summers, or even Anna Leith, would have behaved. She would not have talked too much. She would not have been either restless or embarrassed. But her adaptability, her appropriateness, would not have been nature but act. The oddness of the situation would have made sleep impossible, or, if weariness had overcome her for a moment, she would have waked with a start, wondering where she was, and how as he had come there, and if her hair were tidy, and nothing short of hairpins and a glass would have restored her self-possession. The reflection set him wondering whether the sheltered girl's bringing up might not unfit her for all subsequent contact with life. How much nearer to it had Mrs. Leith been brought by marriage and motherhood, and the passage of 14 years? What were all her reticences and evasions, but the result of the deadening process of forming a addy? The freshness he had marveled at was like the unnatural whiteness of flowers forced in the dark. As he looked back at their few days together, he saw that their intercourse had been marked, on her part, by the same hesitations and reserves which had chilled their earlier intimacy. Once more they had had their hour together, and as he had wasted it. As in her girlhood, her eyes had made promises which her lips were afraid to keep. She was still afraid of life, of its ruthlessness, its danger and mystery. She was still the petted little girl who cannot be left alone in the dark. His memory flew back to their youthful story, and long forgotten details took shape before him. How frail and faint the picture was. They seemed, he and she, like the ghostly lovers of the Grecian urn, forever pursuing without ever clasping each other. To this day he did not quite know what had parted them. The break had been as fortuitous as the fluttering apart of two seed vessels on the wave of summer air. The very slightness, vagueness, of the memory, gave it an added poignancy. He felt the mystic pang of the parent for a child which has just breathed and died. Why had it happened thus, when the least shifting of influences might have made it all so different? If as he had been given to him, then he would have put warmth in her veins and light in her eyes. Would have made her a woman through and through. Musing thus, he had the sense of waste, that is the bitterest harvest of experience. A love like his might have given her the divine gift of self-renewal, and now he saw her fated to wane into old age repeating the same gestures, echoing the words as he had always heard, and perhaps never guessing that, just outside her glazed and curtained consciousness, life rolled away, a vast blackness starred with lights, like the night landscape beyond the windows of the train. The engine lowered its speed for the passage through a sleeping station. In the light of the platform lamp, Darrow looked across at his companion. Her head had dropped toward one shoulder, and her lips were just far enough apart for the reflection of the upper one to deepen the color of the other. The jolting of the train had again shaken loose the lock above her ear. It danced on her cheek like the flit of a brown wing over flowers, and Darrow felt an intense desire to lean forward and put it back behind her ear. Ivy, as their motor cab, on the way from the Gare du Nord, turned into the central glitter of the boulevard, Darrow had bent over to point out an incandescent threshold. There. Above the doorway, an arch of flame flashed out the name of a great actress, whose closing performances in a play of unusual originality had been the theme of long articles in the Paris papers which Darrow had tossed into their compartment at Calais. That's what you must see before you're 24 hours older. The girl followed his gesture eagerly. She was all awake and alive now, as if the heady rumors of the streets, with their long effervescences of light, had passed into her veins like wine. Certain? Is that where she acts? She put her head out of the window, straining back for a glimpse of the sacred threshold. As they flew past it, she sank into her seat with a satisfied sigh. It's delicious enough just to know she's there. I've never seen her, you know. When I was here with Mamie Hoke, we never went anywhere but to the music halls, because she couldn't understand any French. And when I came back afterward to the Farlows, I was dead broke, and couldn't afford the play, and neither could they, So the only chance we had was when friends of theirs invited us, and once it was to see a tragedy by a Romanian lady, and the other time it was for Lamai Fritz at the Frankace. Daryl laughed. Who must do better than that now? Lavertige is a fine thing, and certain gets some wonderful effects out of it. You must come with me tomorrow evening, to see it with your friends, of course. That is, he added, if there's any sort of chance of getting seats. The flash of a street lamp lit up her radiant face. Oh, will you really take us? What fun to think that it's tomorrow already. It was wonderfully pleasant to be able to give such pleasure. Daryl was not rich, but it was almost impossible for him to picture the state of persons with tastes and perceptions like his own, to whom an evening at the theater was an unattainable indulgence. There floated through his mind an answer of Mrs. Leith's to his inquiry whether she had seen the play in question. And no. I meant to, of course, but one is so overwhelmed with things in Paris. And then I'm rather sick of certain one is always being dragged to see her. That, among the people he frequented, was the usual attitude toward such opportunities. There were too many, they were a nuisance, one had to defend oneself. He even remembered wondering, at the moment, whether to a really fine taste the exceptional thing could ever become indifferent through habit, whether the appetite for beauty was so soon dulled that it could be kept alive only by privation. Here, at any rate, was a fine chance to experiment with such a hunger. He almost wished he might stay on in Paris long enough to take the measure of Miss Viner's receptivity. She was still dwelling on his promise, it's too beautiful of you. Oh, don't you think you'll be able to get seats? And then, after a pause of brimming appreciation, I wonder if you'll think me horrid, but it may be my only chance, and if you can't get places for us all, wouldn't you perhaps just take me? After all, the Farlows may have seen it. He had not, of course, thought her horrid, but only the more engaging, for being so natural, and so unashamed of showing the frank greed of her famished youth. You shall go somehow. He had gaily promised her, and as he had dropped back with a sigh of pleasure as their cab passed into the dimly lit streets of the Farlow's quarter beyond the Seine. This little passage came back to him the next morning, as he opened his hotel window on the early roar of the northern terminus. The girl was there, in the room next to him. That had been the first point in his waking consciousness. The second was a sense of relief at the obligation imposed on him by this unexpected turn of events. To wake to the necessity of action, to postpone perforce the fruitless contemplation of his private grievance, was cause enough for gratitude, even if the small adventure in which he found himself involved had not, on its own merits, roused an instinctive curiosity to see it through. When he and his companion, the night before, had reached the Farlow's door in the Rue de la Chaise, it was only to find, after repeated assaults on its panels, that the Farlows were no longer there. They had moved away the week before, not only from their apartment but from Paris, and Miss Viner's breach with Mrs. Murd had been too sudden to permit her letter and telegram to overtake them. Both communications, no doubt, still reposed in a pigeonhole of the loge, but its custodian, when drawn from his lair, sulkily declined to let Miss Viner verify the fact, and only flung out, in return for Darrow's bribe, the statement that the Americans had gone to Joigny. To pursue them there at that hour was manifestly impossible, and Miss Viner, disturbed but not disconcerted by this new obstacle, had quite simply acceded to Darrow's suggestion that she should return for what remained of the night to the hotel where he had sent his luggage. The drive back through the dark hush before dawn, with the nocturnal blaze of the boulevard fading around them like the false lights of a magician's palace, had so played on her impressionability that she seemed to give no farther thought to her own predicament. Darrow noticed that she did not feel the beauty and mystery of the spectacle as much as its pressure of human significance, all its hidden implications of emotion and adventure. As they passed the shadowy colonnade of the Francaise, remote and temple-like in the paling lights, he felt a clutch on his arm, and heard the cry, "Colin, there are things there that I want so desperately to see." And all the way back to the hotel she continued to question him, with shrewd precision and an artless thirst for detail, about the theatrical life of Paris. He was struck afresh, as he listened, by the way in which her naturalness eased the situation of constraint, leaving to it only a pleasant savor of good fellowship. It was the kind of episode that one might, in advance, have characterized as awkward, yet that was proving, in the event, as much outside such definitions as a sunrise stroll with a dryad in a dew-drenched forest. And Darrow reflected that mankind would never have needed to invent tact if it had not first invented social complications. It had been understood, with his good night to Miss Viner, that the next morning he was to look up the Joigny trains and see her safely to the station. But, while he breakfasted it and waited for a timetable, he recalled again her cry of joy at the prospect of seeing certain. It was certainly a pity, since that most elusive and incalculable of artists was leaving the next week for South America, to miss what might be a last sight of her in her greatest part. And Darrow, having dressed and made the requisite excerpts from the timetable, decided to carry the result of his deliberations to his neighbor's door. It instantly opened at his knock, and she came forth looking as if he had been plunged into some sparkling element which had curled up all her drooping tendrils, and wrapped her in a shimmer of fresh leaves. "Well, what do you think of me?" she cried, and with a hand at her waist she spun about, as if to show off some miracle of Parisian dressmaking. "I think the missing trunk has come, and that it was worth waiting for. You do like my dress?" "I adore it. I always adore new dresses." "Why, you don't mean to say it's not a new one?" She laughed out her triumph. "No, no, no. My trunk hasn't come, and this is only my old rag of yesterday, but I never knew the trick to fail." And, as he stared, "Colin, you see," she joyously explained, "I've always had to dress in all kinds of dreary leftovers, and sometimes, when everybody else was smart and new, it used to make me awfully miserable. So one day, when Mrs. Murrett dragged me down unexpectedly, to fill a place at dinner, I suddenly thought I'd try spinning around like that, and say to everyone, 'Well, what do you think of me? ... and, do you know, they were all taken in, including Mrs. Murrett, who didn't recognize my old turned and dyed rags, and told me afterward it was awfully bad form to dress, as if I were somebody that people would expect to know. And ever since, whenever I've particularly wanted to look nice, I've just asked people what they thought of my new frock, and they're always, always taken in.'" She dramatized her explanation so vividly that Darrow felt as if his point were gained. "Ah, but this confirms your vocation, of course," he cried. "You must see certain." And, seeing her face fall at this reminder of the change in her prospects, he hastened to set forth his plan. As he did so, he saw how easy it was to explain things to her. She would either accept his suggestion, or she would not. But at least she would waste no time in protestations and objections, or any vain sacrifice to the idols of conformity. The conviction that one could, on any given point, almost predicate this of her, gave him the sense of having advanced far enough in her intimacy to urge his arguments against a hasty pursuit of her friends. Yes, it would certainly be foolish, she at once agreed, in the case of such dear and definite angels as the Farlows, to dash off after them without more positive proof that they were established at Joigny, and so established that they could take her in. She owned it was but too probable that they had gone there to a town, and might be doing so in quarters too contracted to receive her, and it would be unfair, on that chance, to impose herself on them unannounced. The simplest way of getting farther light on the question would be to go back to the Rue de la Chaise, where, at that more conversable hour, the concierge might be less chary of detail, and she could decide on her next step in the light of such facts as he imparted. Point by point, she fell in with the suggestion, recognizing, in the light of their unexplained flight, that the Farlows might indeed be in a situation on which one could not too rashly intrude. Her concern for her friend seemed to have effaced all thought of herself, and this little indication of character gave Darrow a quite disproportionate pleasure. She agreed that it would be well to go at once to the Rue de la Chaise, but met his proposal that they should drive by the declaration that it was a waste not to walk in Paris, so they set off on foot through the cheerful tumult of the streets. The walk was long enough for him to learn many things about Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.